You're listening to WPVM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. 103.7 on your dial and streaming globally at WPVMFM.org.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Stuart Smith. A framework peace deal has been reached between the US and Iran. It promises to end hostilities and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The deal was announced by Pakistan's Prime Minister, who has been helping mediate the talks. From Islamabad, Hira Mustafa reports.
What we understand is that Pakistan's role doesn't end here. Now even the most toughest phase begins. And that would be the implementation of the peace deal and the confidence-building measures between the U.S. and Iran. And Pakistan will remain engaged with the regional players, including China, Qatar, Kuwait, Turkey, and other international players who helped achieve this peace deal supported the diplomatic process. So Pakistan's role has become even more important than ever before. Ever since the war in Iran began, the Strait of Hormuz, which is a critical waterway through which majority of the trade happens worldwide.
Evian.
The French spa town of Evian on the shoreline of Lake Geneva is hosting this year's summit of the leaders of France, the US, the UK, Germany, Italy, Japan and Canada. And there is high security here ahead of the arrival of the heads of state and government later on Monday. Emmanuel Macron and Donald Trump will hold face-to-face talks after the news that the US and Iran have agreed to sign a peace accord in Switzerland later this week, and future post-conflict planning, especially regarding the Strait of Hormuz, will form the major part of Monday's talks. Ross Cullen, Evian.
Voters in Switzerland have rejected a plan to cap the country's population at 10 million people. The proposal was put forward by the right-wing Swiss People's Party, who argued the move would ease housing, transportation and environmental concerns. William Denslow reports from Brussels.
The population of Switzerland currently stands at just over 9 million, and the plan would have set a cap at 10 million by the year 2050. Just under 55% of voters rejected the proposal, with many citing concerns over the impact it would have on the labour market and ties with the European Union. Over half of Swiss produce is sold in the EU, and the introduction of a population limit could have impacted the country's access to Europe's single market. The president of the Swiss People's Party says the result of the referendum shows that people want solutions, and not a single problem has been solved with the vote's outcome. William Denslow, Brussels.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks, with more today on the action by the Royal Navy seizing a Russian vessel that is part of Vladimir Putin's shadow fleet, moving sanctioned oil around the world. There are more than 700 vessels in that fleet, and the British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer has promised action against them as increasing numbers have sailed in UK waters.
I think the real question here is, why didn't they do it earlier? There really should be more aggressive action.
Stephanie Baker is with Bloomberg News and author of Punishing Putin, Inside the Global Economic War to Bring Down Russia.
This is the first time since, as you mentioned, in March, Keir Starmer outlined that they had discovered that they had a legal basis to actually board and detain ships in violation of sanctions law. We expected some action. I think there had been some speculation that there was a Russian frigate protecting some of the vessels going through the English Channel. But I have long argued that this is a real environmental risk, that a lot of these shadow fleet vessels are traveling through the English Channel with very dodgy insurance. We don't know if there were to be some accident or spill, if there would be insurance backing that up, or if that would be the UK taxpayer on the hook for it.
The seized vessel, the Smirtos, will now be held off the coast of southwest England as investigations continue. Moscow says the action is illegal and borders on piracy. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
To recap the top stories, a framework deal has been reached between the US and Iran, which promises to end hostilities and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. But the vast majority of ships are staying put until the deal is signed and details made public on Friday. British children under 16 will be banned from social media platforms sometime next year, after the UK chose to follow Australia's attempt at a solution to the dangers of social media. And the son of Norway's crown princess has been found guilty on two counts of rape. That's the latest feature story news. Stuart Smith reporting.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Plenty of sunshine across the area today. A few clouds around, the high near 79. Then for tonight, becoming mostly cloudy, a low dropping to around 57. Mostly sunny across the mountains on Tuesday, the high near 82 here in town. Partly cloudy for Tuesday night, the low 58. Looking ahead to Wednesday, the high near 86 with lots of sunshine, 65 for Wednesday night. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Hello, folks. Thanks for joining us on Head Inside Mental Health, featuring conversations about mental health and substance use treatment with experts, advocates, and professionals from across the country, sharing their thoughts and insights on the world of behavioral health care. Broadcasting on WPVM 103.7, the voice of Asheville, independent commercial-free radio. I'm Todd Weatherly, your host, therapeutic consultant and behavioral expert. With me today is dad extraordinaire, clinician, neurobiology expert, Dr. Rob Gent. Dr. Gent is an accomplished clinician and expert in psychotherapeutic development with a distinguished career that spans over two decades. He serves now as the chief clinical officer for Pacific Quest, a residential mental health care program for adolescents and young adults on the Big Island in Hawaii. Dr. Rob holds a PhD in psychology with an emphasis on neurobiology and the science of relationship and development. His work is centered on the advancement and development of integrative health, where neurobiological, psychological, physiological, and relational development intermediate to create optimal healing and functionality. He remains deeply committed to innovating the science of integrative health and implementing research to enhance the effectiveness of therapeutic interventions and residential care. Dr. Gent is a nationally recognized presenter, educator, and expert in the field of clinical therapy and treatment. His personal and professional journey reflects commitment to excellence in both his family life and his work. Dr. Rob, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Wow. Thanks, Todd. Such a privilege to be here and be able to talk with you today.
No, the privilege is mine. I'm just glad you took the 6 hour. We were able to navigate the 6 hour time difference and make it work. Early morning for you. It's already afternoon for us. How's the Big Island going?
Yeah, Big Island is beautiful. I feel very fortunate to be able to be at this place in my career, to be able to be here working with adolescents and young adults, and more importantly, with families and their parents. And there's this ongoing need, of course. What does family systems work look like? You know, I just will say it really quickly. We're seeing this big gap between how old are these kids chronologically in years versus how old they are emotionally, developmentally. Yeah. And so it's been a big topic
in conferences lately.
I've
gotten to see you speak, but I'm seeing others, and it's, you know, we you know, Ericksonian kind of logic doesn't quite fit anymore. No. It really doesn't. You know, you can't take a kid's age and look at it and say, hey, and you know, I have to say, I'm super excited to have you as a guest on the show today, because you are one of the most uniquely positioned people to speak to not only what's going on with families and adolescents and the stages of development, and how we see it in the kids that are coming at us today, both in treatment and schools and everywhere else, but also, you know, you were chief clinical officer at a large behavioral health company that owned lots of programs. I remember, gosh, 5-6 years ago, remember having you, you were running all around the country. You were, you know, Utah and North Carolina and California, you were going back and forth, you know, either reviewing a program or supporting a, you know, one of the clinical directors. And you were seeing the span of treatment as it is delivered from adolescent, you know, 13 to 28. I doubt there's anything in that age group, you know, from a treatment perspective that you haven't seen so far. And then you jumped across the water to go over to what is ultimately a much smaller and intimate program. And the Big Island, people don't think of the Big Island this way, but it really is kind of remote.
It's kind of a remote area. There's not a lot going on in the Big Island. There's a lot of tourism, but it's like a small town on a big island. Having been there and having seen the program and everything, I wonder, how is it you compare the work you saw being at the helm of the behavioral health company with multiple programs in your view, down to looking at it from this, you know, a little bit more microscopic, like really getting invested in some of what it looks like for families and the clients that are referred to Pacific Quest and the kinds of problems you're seeing? Where do you see the contrast? What's the contrast in your view from a programming perspective? What's that been like for you?
Yeah, appreciate the question, Todd. Yeah, it was an intentional shift for sure to go from this national big company. And a little bit of an anecdotal story is that it was presenting and traveling, as you know, you saw me multiple places, and I kept seeing these common themes around nutrition, gut brain access. What are we seeing over and over again? We were wondering, you know, I would talk to clinicians and, you know, these kids were in a little bit of a brain fog, something was going on. And I would say to them, well, just ask them what they've had to eat in the last couple of days.
Or the last hour, you know,
in the last hour. And then I would get this response of like, oh, wow, come to find out it was a bag of Takis and a package of Oreos that they've had. And we wondered why they weren't had this fluid thinking, and the vulnerability was tough, and there's ADHD and there's all of this stuff. And so we were seeing that pattern happening across the nation. And so I was very intrigued to look at it, to be able to refocus in a way where I wanted to really, really get down and understand. And Pacific Quest, I came here and spent a lot of time with them, and they have a very strong medical component to look at this principle of integrative health. So the psychiatrist, the psychiatry, the medical staff here looking at how do we look at functional psychiatry, integrative health and medicine, and tie that all into psychotherapy was this opportunity that I had not seen anywhere else and being able to prioritize it. I mean, you've been in this industry. You know how limited a psychiatrist's time is. You know that a true medical doctor looking at this relationship and then having professionals in a psychotherapeutic dynamic, it is very expensive and very hard to come by. Many people will say that, well, that's not the most profitable business model. That's true. But I knew that coming here in Pacific Quest was ability to be able to really refine and seeing what the need is and how to treat that from looking at working with a psychiatrist. What medications are people on? Are we seeing an accurate diagnosis? I mean, medications are so overprescribed now and absolutely essential, but the medications need to be assessed in an ongoing environment where we could balance out. And this is what I knew Pacific Quest was very good at and why I wanted to be here, is that, you know, get them off the sugars, get them into, you know, great unprocessed food, whole foods, get the right amount of sleep, the exercise, being outside. At this stage too, when we talk about residential treatment, as you know, Todd, it's like, I mean, who doesn't call or who doesn't struggle with, I don't know what to do about screens and my kid, they're addicted to their phone. They won't get off of it. And they're just locked in their room or they're just absorbed by this stuff. So Pacific Quest for me was coming to the Big Island was a chance to get this population that was still occurring on the mainland, but get them into this very contained environment that we could really strip it away and do assessment and treatment in a much different way.
But yeah, I was going to say, in seeing the results, because I know you've had your hand in research, like what are you seeing in the numbers? Are you getting to like do some comparative and get some other folks involved and colleagues and look at what this what from a research standpoint is looking like? What do the numbers look like right now? What do you see?
Yeah, so you know, we are part of the NATSAP ongoing research project through the NATSAP and thanks to Mike Petrie and R2D2 and all of that. Yeah, we've been a gold member. Pacific Quest has been a gold member contributor, so we can see lots of outcomes. What's really been fascinating comparatively is to see the amount of getting out of clinically indicated numbers, clinical levels, into healthier, much healthier numbers in a quicker fashion. And when we look at like the SWL, we'll do the, you know, it's a measure of well-being. We see these rates are much faster than other programs. And I believe the correlation is to exercise, movement, nutrition, looking at the type of psychotherapy we are doing, looking at this from a developmental lens, working with the family systems, all of that together, I have seen compared to, I was doing outcomes at this very large behavioral health company, we're seeing a much quicker access to healthier numbers. And then I, of course, want to look at it long-term too. The numbers really reveal that there's more productivity to move these kids into healthier baselines quicker. Anxiety, depression, all of that's improving. We make sure that we do a family assessment device called the FAD to be able to measure family interaction. And that's a huge piece because all of the physiological stuff we can do, Todd, I always kind of laugh at this, and we can put meds at it. There's still no pill for shame.
Right. Doesn't seem to resolve, even though the person has got less depression or whatever, right? Or less anxiety. The shame is still there.
Yeah, and those are all integrated, right? I mean, we're seeing the shame, the anxiety, the depression, those things, and the trauma. When we can talk about all of this stuff, significantly impacts the shame, and we can take medications to, you know, slow the brain down and treat the ADHD and do all of this stuff, which is really great. But as I say, there's no pill for shame, but we know the resolution to shame needs to be this empathetic process. We can talk, you know, boundaries, expectation, rules, all of these things, and how to set up appropriate structure for a kid to thrive, adolescent, young adult. How do we calm their nervous system with this structure that we can then move into a place of resolving shame? That's been a significant piece for us, for sure.
I think that you stated this in the beginning. Some of the issue that we deal with in the world at large is one, silos.
You know, yeah,
you got the medical doc over here, and you got the psychiatrist over here. They're not seeing the client for more than 20 minutes, and they're not talking to one another. And you know, to get an integrated approach, to get a team of people, especially in an outpatient version, where all the therapist and the doc and the people are talking to one another. And then there's the other thing, which is I heard some report the other day. It's like, well, you know, the problem is that nobody's setting off fireworks and doing promos for broccoli. Like, because it's broccoli. It's, you know, Whole Foods there. It's not a sexy thing. It's, you know, you make a lot more money on Takis, you know, you make a lot more money on video games and phones than you make on broccoli and solid proteins and stuff that's cooked at home and those kinds of things. When you get a family and you see this, I'm sure, or you probably don't get to see it as much now because you get to, you know, exist in an environment where you're focused with an integrated team. But the rest of the world out there, for kids who can't afford to come to Hawaii and receive treatment, which I wish they could, and kids that are in communities, maybe they're not at a residential level of care yet, and they're, you know, they're having trouble in school, they're doing a lot of refusal stuff at home, mom and dad are struggling with, like, setting the limits on screens and setting the limits on bedtimes and everything else, and then they start to have this symptomology. They're having suicidal thoughts, or they're having depression or anxiety. If you were going to say something to a family that's out there on this cusp of, like, maybe needing residential care, what's something that you would say to them with all the experience that you have? What advice would you give a family that's sitting on that right now?
Yeah, that's a great question, Todd. And I definitely, the first thing that I would express to this family is, what's reliable and predictable as far as maintaining safety within the home?
Oh, yeah, that's a really great way to phrase that. Wow. Say more about that.
Well, we talk about that. What is the most loving thing that you can provide for a child? Reliable, predictable boundaries. Parents often these days, and I find myself saying this, if I'm talking to parents or doing a coaching or whatever I'm doing with parents, I'll often ask, do you feel held hostage? 99% of parents said, I totally feel held hostage. The cart is pulling the horse around. We're afraid that, you know, they'll move immediately to self-harm or they'll move into a place of threatening suicide. So we don't feel like we can leverage anything. So it's great to come up with all of these consequences and stuff. But, you know, I'm sure you've heard this from a lot of parents these days, too. Gosh, I don't even know how to set limits with the cell phone because they do everything through screen time. Their school, everything is in this. And so it's hard to parse that out. So for me, it really is about, I would say to parents, really look at what is all about maintaining and sustaining emotional and physical safety has to be number one. Can you do this in the home? My encouragement, if you can do this from home, do this from home. This is great. Can you provide enough system? But what are those basic boundaries? And let's talk about natural and logical and relational consequences. That's super important for parents to be able to say, okay, so I need to really look at how do I set a foundation? That's right. And that can be extremely hard to do, Todd, especially in this day and age where you're like, parents don't feel like they have a lot of leverage.
Well, I like this, but you know, you proceed at it like, what's the most loving thing you can do for your kid? You know, it's hard to come up with a bad response that's the most loving thing. And I know that parents can be enmeshed and can be boundaryless and maybe they come up with something that's not right about what's the most loving thing. I have a family at work, so I'm just using this interview for free advice is what I'm doing.
Totally.
I've got a client that I'm working with right now, and you know, it's a kid kind of in this position, be a kid that would be probably, in my view, very appropriate for your program. We'd get a lot of benefits for it. But one of the things that he, you know, you probably guess, kind of on the spectrum, maybe some OCD, you know, OCD's been diagnosed, anxiety, suicidal ideation. The mom came up with something, and I applauded her. Something happened, a limit came up, and she needed to set it. He wouldn't do something, and so, well, I'm going to take the phone. But she knows her child well enough that, you know, she said, I'm taking the phone. You don't have access to it right now. I understand that it makes you feel safe. So I'm going to leave the phone right here on the table. I'm not taking it out on the room. I'm just telling you that you're not allowed to use it. I'll know whether you do. But it will be in your sight so that it's not left and you know that it's there because I know that it's also a comfort. And that was the, like, and he did go use the phone. Which is amazing to me, but she knew her child well enough. So this piece about relational work, because I think we hear, you know, especially with the media that we've got today, like you hear what is supposed to be how you set a limit with a child, or you hear what tough love is, or you hear all these stories and things like that. But, and this is your field of expertise, something you focused on a lot, but what's your favorite? Give me one of your favorite stories on the use of a relational dynamic when you're working with these kids that are struggling with this stuff. Like, what's one of your favorite stories or approaches for that matter?
Well, I certainly think the story about this mom illustrates some really wonderful principles. For her, she understands the boundary that the phone is a no-go because what's the boundary? There should be no self-injurious behavior. If that phone is going to heighten anxiety and have some maladaptive, unproductive stuff, certainly the mom does what? She sets some really clear rules and expectations around the phone, which is great. More importantly, because that boundary is reliable, that she knows that we could just turn off the phone. The phone's inaccessible. She feels like she has some control over that. She's actually freed up to do what? I love this. She's freed up to be then so attuned with her own kid that she says, what? If he's on the spectrum somewhere, boy, we could talk about spectrum brains, and they get very stuck in the left hemisphere, and they're very logic minded, and the anxiety
way, you know,
it's got to be, there's some rigidity, and I got to see the phone. I mean, I applaud this mom. She's like, I'm going to set it right here. But the expectation, the rule is very clear to help maintain his anxiety. That's terrific. So she's able to move into this place of having some relational attunement and sensitivity. And that's actually done because, believe it or not, she has confidence in the boundary that can be maintained. And I think that's the problem. I tell this story a lot. Parents, if boundaries aren't, if there's not a clear path to follow through and maintain the boundaries, then we're always in this triage mode. We always held hostage. And how many parents have you spoken to, Todd, or dealt with, where you can feel this, like they're in micromanagement mode. They're killing themselves with micromanagement. And then they're getting into this pattern of the kid finding loopholes. And I call it the behavioral hamster wheel. They're on this behavioral hamster wheel trying to maintain all of this, and they miss the relationship. Because I like to talk about this principle. We want to move from physical leverage to relational leverage. And that's a developmental thing that most parents would love. Oh, great. I don't have to get all this physical leverage and threaten all this stuff or leverage all. It's really about developmentally, we're into relational compassion and understanding and regret and remorse, all of these pro-social developmental things that oftentimes I hear these kids struggle with. Does your kid have empathy? No, they're incredibly selfish. Let's talk about why and how to get there. Shame in itself breeds selfishness. And being the victim. Shame strips us of real accountability.
Well, in limit setting, you know, when a kid gets in trouble, shame's part of it. It's like, hey, you've done something wrong. You know, why you should feel ashamed of that. Do something else because you don't want to feel ashamed anymore. But, I see the dynamic that exists for families at times when it's, you know, they chase after limits, and they chase after being smart, being more clever than their child, which, I mean, almost universally, the child wins this race because they're just, you know, they've got more free time really in the end to kind of figure, I can get out the window this way or out of the house this way or get these substances or whatever it is I'm after. They're very clever at going after one thing that they want. And when they feel like the thing that causes their anxiety resolve, even if it's unhealthy, is being taken from them. It's just like you say, you've stripped them of safety. They don't know how to be safe without that phone, drugs, you know, some, you know, indulgent relationship, whatever it may be. They don't know how to feel safe about that. They've figured out a way to feel safe doing this. It's unhealthy. Yes, we see that. And you're going to go at it from trying to take it away from them. And it's like, you know, they talk about this with kids on the spectrum as well. It's like, you've got to go at it from a safety standpoint. Like, what is it that causes this person to feel safe? And the other thing I think that kind of gets us past some of the game, which is, well, you want your kid to be safe. Your kid actually wants to be safe, even though what they're doing is not safe, but they want to feel whether it safety may be belonging, you know, it may be that there's a feeling they're getting out of the thing they're doing, and that causes them to relax or abate anxiety. And, you know, if you can ask a really good question, it's like, how do you and I both get the need met that we're looking at? Then you can be relational and you might, you know, involve your child. For you as a clinician, and you're over the whole team, so you get to see all these, you know, clever new clinicians trying new things and all the cool stuff. Like, what are the cool interventions that you're seeing that your treatment team comes up with and that your direct care staff and therapists are coming up that? What are the cool things that you're seeing out there that are really working with kids from a relational and safety standpoint?
I really appreciate you talk about safety, and I'll just throw a little bit of neurobiological stint to it.
Why not? While we're at it.
If that's okay. But yeah, so I like to talk about this principle of regulation versus dysregulation. A lot of we throw these terms around. What's regulated versus what's dysregulated? When we're not safe and our nervous system is on high alert, we call it hypervigilance or whatever that looks like. Believe it or not, that's unsafe. When we're out of our window of tolerance and I use Dan Siegel's hand model of the brain, and our lid is flipped, our cortex is not attached, the firing is not happening between the rational brain and the emotional brain and the nervous system.
Cassidy goes straight down through it goes through the toilet, you know?
It goes right in the toilet. Yeah, we call this lid flip. It can be, this is dysregulation. And I often tell parents, and I love that we as a program understand this, that we often get fooled that calm equals regulation. And that is not true. Calm does not equal regulation. How many kids are the proverbial hoodie and they're just isolating and they're tucked away and they're in a, you know, an overwhelmed dopaminergic system. They're so overflooded. Yeah, they're dysregulated, but they can present as calm or they're shut down or whatever that means. And so for us, back to your question is, it's really wonderful to get back to this place. Now, we have the luxury of there's no cell phones or they don't bring them to treatment. So we've created an environment that has removed it. Now, do they need to go through this detox period? Part of this, Todd, as you understand, is that we have the luxury as kids come to us, they get off the sugars, they get off the carbs, they get off the screens, they do a full detox, believe it or not. And there's a relational piece to this. They're immersed into what I call the secure base. And developmentally, that means they're immersed and surrounded by people who are committed to doing what's developmentally best for them. So instead of timeouts, they get time ins. We're transforming, we're creating neuroplasticity in a way to help that regulation. They have to go through this process of recognizing what does it mean to be regulated. Now, we have done some wonderful things. I can think of an anecdote. We had this young man, an adolescent, who was very high IQ, high anxiety, super smart kid, has been through lots of treatment, seen all these outpatient therapists. Very dysregulated, but showing up every day and being able to go into the gardens and take some ownership, put his hands in the dirt, be able to look at, hey, I got to water plants, I got to care, and being able to see some growth. Doing that with some staff for us brought him to a point of regulation that we knew we had a foothold for him. So whenever he would start to lose it and get dysregulated and become really in a state of maybe wanting to slip into a sympathetic reaction, fight or flight, or get super defensive, going in. So an intervention for us is using some gardens that will go into the gardens and do some horticulture stuff. There's an ability to hop in the water. Let's get in the ocean. Let's do those things. But more importantly, it's about this relational context. What's reliable and predictable with the relationships that I'm having in the structure that I'm in. That's the number one thing to help these students move from a place of dysregulation to a place of regulation is really starts with relationship. What's reliable and what's predictable. We know that's the biggest thing. So we talk a lot about shame. I mean, it sounds like a little placating, but you know, Todd, our goal is shame causes dysregulation. If you've got ADHD, there's a strong correlation between ADHD. Are you familiar with the work of Robert Sapolsky out of Stanford?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It gets brought up a lot and with guests that come on the show.
Sapolsky's work talks about some of his research says our physiological states are correlated to our social emotional states. Meaning that as we're filled with cortisol, it has a distinct relationship between states of cortisol and actually states of shame.
Wow.
How many of these kids have lid flips are filled with all kinds of cortisol, stress hormone, all of that's going on with them, dopaminergic system, adrenaline fatigue, because they're always seeking this input. All of that produces a certain state is correlated to this principle of shame. And what's the only antidote to shame? Thank you, Brené Brown. Empathy.
It brings me to a story. So I'll share a little personal story.
Yeah, please.
I've been married almost 30 years. So I share this story to talk about how slow I am, really. But, you know, my wife was a military kid, you know, like jumped around, moved to all kinds of places, which also meant that, you know, suddenly you strip away from your friends and you go to a whole new environment. Hawaii was one of them. She lived on the island of Hawaii and experienced in Hawaii racism because she was not Asian. You know, she had a teacher who was Asian, and, you know, she has these trauma stories that are associated with school. And a lot of them, as you might imagine, revolve around shame. Revolve around, you know, you're not good enough, or, you know, you're not included in the social group, or these friends are not, you know, her story is not different than so many others that are out there. And so, you know, anytime we've gotten the heated debates or the quibbles or the whatever else, a lot of the way that we approach conflict, I think, at least, you know, having looked at it as a professional, having experienced it as a person, a lot of the way that we approach a conflict with a person, if you've done something and I don't agree with that something, and I want to go to you and tell you about the thing that you did and how it's wrong, and there's a conflict, there's a disagreement. It's like, well, you wouldn't want to be wrong, would you? A person would be ashamed to be wrong. And we approach it from our approach to conflict is shame-based in society largely right now, I think, at least from what I'm seeing. And I can't say that I was ever necessarily different. It's like, well, you know, you do it the right way. You don't do it the wrong way. That's the wrong way. Who would do it the wrong way? You should be ashamed of that. Anytime I would approach my wife this way, I got into trouble. And I realized about 25 years in, I'm like, my wife hates to feel ashamed. And if I want her to do something, you know, for me differently, I just need to talk about the thing that I need, not her being ashamed of something. Because when I do that, it triggers the response that's like, you know, from childhood long ago. And I'm like, you know, and then I was like, you know, I think I actually do the same thing. If somebody tells me that I'm a terrible person because I did something wrong and I should feel ashamed, I'm like, who the heck do you think you are? I could, you know, like the reaction, just the base reaction, I feel like that as humans that we are, you know, we sit in the midst of. And the reason why we use shame as this mechanism is because, thank you, Brené Brown, we forget to be empathic. We forget to have empathy for the person that we're working. It's like, why would they do that? You know, maybe I felt this way about this, but maybe it wasn't about me. So what is it about that we're actually dealing with? And you go that you, one, you come up with far more sophisticated ways to deal with problems, first of all. And two, you end up in a relationship that's deeper and more sensitive and more, you know, more attuned. I love this word, more attuned. So that you can actually be with one another in ways that are effective. And that sounds like what you're teaching these kids, you know? Are you teaching that to families? I guess that's the question now. I know that you are, so that's a trick question. But, like, how are you teaching this to families? Because kids get through with treatment, and they go home, and then they've got to land all this stuff back in the environment that they came from. How's that? Like, how does that look for you as a clinician, seeing these kids go off and return?
You're bringing up the most critical piece, really, Todd, is how do we create the change within the family system? Because, I mean, how many families have you seen good, great treatment, and you plop them back right into the same environment that they were before? You know, and when it comes to substance abuse, how many times, I'm forgetting if it was SAMHSA or somebody did this research, but how many times do people go into substance use treatment before it starts to take root and their environment changes? 8 times before they recognize, gosh, I have to change my environment. I have to change my supportive system to be able to make sure that these are long-lasting changes. 8 times on average before it starts to take root. Can you imagine that? I mean, that's a lot of treatment. And the point is to really work with changing in the environment. So back to your question, how do we work with parents? Yeah, the parents are so critical to be able to move them into a place of they have to practice empathy. And that can be very hard because we'll talk about the nervous system. When we're on high alert or we're in triage mode, the luxury of empathy is a higher order thing. If we're in the moment and we're ourselves in the sympathetic and we're just worried about keeping our kid alive and doing this, we're on triage mode. We're not set for empathy. Bottom of my lid is flipped. I'm trying to give them my resources just to put out the fire. So when we can get parents to a place of recognizing that their kids are safe in the moment, it actually calms their nervous system. This is the work of parents. They can actually get back online. They calm their nervous system, and then they're in a place to actually evoke empathy. But here's one key thing that we don't often talk about. Empathy, Dr. Dan Siegel, if you guys are familiar with Dr. Sam Siegel's work, Louis Cozzolino will tell you, empathy is the most efficient and effective mechanism for healthy development. Empathy. Brené Brown talks about it's the only antidote to shame. That's great, but here's the big piece. Empathy is only as effective as the person's boundaries are reliable and predictable. Let me repeat that. Somebody's empathy is only as effective as they are reliable and predictable. And I'll say to parents, have you ever been given empathy from somebody you don't trust? What does that feel like?
I mean, you're like, what do you want?
It feels disingenuous. It feels placating. It feels yucky, like you don't want it. And what's fascinating is quickly we then transfer it into mom and dad. Are you so reliable? Does your child trust you? Well, you don't have boundaries. We're actually enmeshed. I don't know how to individuate. And if you're okay, then I'm okay. And we get into this that actually it's what's interesting is foundationally, there's not the reliable and predictable structure in place in order to have a real profound sense of trust. So the empathy actually then becomes less effective.
I refer to it with parents as standing still.
Oh, it's like, I love that term.
Learn how to stand still because you're running after them. You know, they're going all over the place. You're running after them. You're also they're okay. You're making your okayness dependent on their okayness.
Yeah.
And they're taking that out to the track and running it around. And you don't even know where you stand. So what I want you to do is I want you to be able to stand still and feel like you're not chasing after your kid. And I realize it's a hard exercise, you know, if you feel like your child is in danger, but it's also, I know that you're probably familiar with this. It's neurodendritic hypersensitivity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I love that term.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, you know, all pain is too much pain, basically, for, you know, opiate addicts. They so develop the sensitivity, or and then you get like five times the dendritic endings around a particular pain area. And yeah. It's like, I think that parents develop this with like they have an emotional neurodendritic hypersensitivity. Like they all potential risk is too much risk. All potential fear of your child being in trouble or all potential anxiety that your child is experiencing is more than you can handle, and you do whatever it is to make it go away. And it just continues to make it worse. And you get to the end of that. You get to the end of the, like a developmental phase of this kind of stuff. And that's when your kids are ended up at Pacific Quest because parents don't know how they're in it. They're stuck. They need help. The kid needs help. Maybe some separation from the environment's a good thing. And then all of a sudden you walk in, you start supporting them. It's like, I'd love to see the lights go on for parents who are like, oh, wow, I have to be stable. Empathic, reliably empathic, establish trust before we can get anywhere on this. Is that what you're telling me? Like the brain, the ahas that come out of that must be pretty incredible. What is next for you? Like, I'm not talking about job or anything else. Like, I know as a person, having seen you present, having read some of your work, I know that you've got a vision for where you want to see not just Pacific Quest, but the work of working with adolescents and young adults go somewhere. What is on the horizon for you in that regard?
Yeah, Appreciate the question, Todd. For me, really moving towards focusing on, we've begun to do at Pacific Quest, really elevate what I call our family intensives. Time that we actually come, the parents will spend multiple days with us. We've got pre-calls, we've got post-calls follow-up, but it's looking at medical, psychiatry, really in interweaving it with the psychotherapy piece. But I'm a big believer in everybody setting their phones aside for a second. Let's calm your nervous systems. Let's create this space. And I'm going to go back to the hand model of the brain for a second. I'm really intrigued by it, and I know that the research is really clear about this. The emotional system, our limbic system, subcortical system, and our nervous system, where our neuroception is, our autonomic nervous system, our central nervous system, has no capacity for words.